Clayton. John Clayton.
Hey, Mom! I'm done with my segment!
This is the Coors Light Cold Hard Facts with John Clayton.
Brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light, Washington's most refreshing beer.
Now, here's a six-pack of questions.
We got the Professor John. We asked last segment, which coach is entering the most doomed situation? Is it Adam Gase and his bulging eyes? Is it Cliff Kingsbury? Who would you say is most likely to fail?
I would put my numbers maybe on Cliff Kingsbury, because he really is in a tough situation. I mean, he comes in with no NFL experience. He comes in with an offensive line that was totally decimated last year. He's got a tough quarterback to try to turn around. There's a lot of needs that they have at the wide receiver position. I mean, if they don't have Larry Fitzgerald and they don't know if they're going to have him, what do they have at wide receiver other than Christian Kirk? So I think that he's probably in the toughest situation of all, because they've got to get a lot of talent to him fast, and he's got to figure out a way trying to learn the NFL as a head coach to be able to turn it around.
John, I was thinking that maybe Adam Gase had those weird eyes. You saw those weird eyes, right?
I did.
Maybe it was because he had to have a rookie quarterback sit in on his interview.
Well, that could be, yeah.
Maybe that was the reason.
Yeah, but I mean, I think he gets along well with quarterbacks, and you know he's going to get along well with Sam Darnold, so I don't think that was much of a factor.
What kind of guy is he, Adam Gase?
I like him. I mean, again, you know he's Joe Vitt's son-in-law.
I do.
I mean, he's a really sharp guy. And the thing that's interesting about him is that, you know, if you ask of all the coaches he's been around who he learned from the most, he learned more from Mike Martz. And you know Mike Martz had a volatile personality and a great mind, and Adam Gase obviously has a great mind and, you know, creates so many different things. But also, from the standpoint, he's very emotional. I think you can see it with the eyes in the press conference, and you hear it in a lot of the things that he did, you know, as with the roster and that. And that, I think, led to his downfall in Miami. I mean, he chased too many Pro Bowl players away. I mean, think about the fact that, you know, he didn't want Mike Pouncey. He didn't want Jarvis Landry. He didn't want Jay Ajayi. I mean, there's about five Pro Bowlers, Ndamukong Suh. He chased all those guys out of there because he gets too emotional. He feels, okay, the locker room's going bad with this guy and that guy, you know, not appreciating the things that Pete Carroll appreciates, you know, because again, players have different personalities, and sometimes they're going to, you know, be good in the locker some days, and sometimes they're going to be bad in the locker some days. Well, if it was a bad day, you know, Adam's ready to get rid of the guy. That's just the emotion that he shows, and I think now in New York, and this could lead to some tough situations for him, it's going to be exposed even more.
Does everybody remember Mike Martz?
I do remember Mike Martz.
You know, I found myself, it was in Mobile, Alabama one year for the Senior Bowl, and all of a sudden I find myself at a table with Mike Martz having a beer. And I thought he was the nicest, coolest, most down-to-earth guy. But you know what, a guy I wanted to ask you about, John, I'm kind of rooting for in the playoffs, is Andy Reid. He just seems like a big, nice guy. I kind of look at his relationship with Mahomes, and I wonder if there's kind of a father-son thing, just their body language and everything. Tell us what you know about Andy Reid.
Well, what I know about Andy Reid is that he's really well schooled as a coach. I mean, he learned so much from Mike Holmgren, and just like in the typical way that Mike Holmgren trains his coaches, particularly those on offense, they kind of start him out on a little learning on the offensive line, coaching some offensive line stuff, and then, you know, gets him maybe over to the tight ends, and then eventually to the quarterbacks. I mean, that's what he did with Andy, and that's why you see a big emphasis with Andy Reid when he's putting teams together, that he gets a good offensive line, and he usually does. You know, the second thing you know about Andy, and he's kind of like that big teddy bear. And it's funny because I think there may have been some lawyer training in him at some point in his life, because if you always hear at the beginning of every press conference, first he'll give the injury report, and then he'll always, because you can, it's almost a matter of fact as far as this goes, he'll come back and he'll say, we like the opportunity to be able to play the New England Patriots. I mean, that's always one of those legal things that you always say, we're looking forward to the opportunity to do this in court. So I think there's a little bit of legal training. And then the thing that I respect the most, because he carried the banner of Mike Holmgren as a pure West Coast guy, to a point where I would go to Eagle games, and if I would see him run the ball 30 times, which he would do maybe once or twice every 2 years, I go down to the locker room and I say, Andy, are you okay? I mean, you don't like running the ball like that. You like throwing the flare passes and the screen passes. I mean, pure West Coast style. And he kind of laugh about that. Another thing to add to it is just how he changed himself. He goes to Kansas City. I mean, he starts to bring in, you know, Chris Ault to learn, you know, the pistol offense. He then starts associating himself with all these guys that have college experience to learn all the college stuff. And now you see he has one of the most diverse, one of the most intricate type of offenses in football.
Boy, he's got a great regular season record, John, but a spotty record in the playoffs. Is he Hall of Fame caliber at all?
Well, again, that's no, because it's hard. I mean, we can't get Jimmy Johnson, Don Coryell, Mike Holmgren, and others in because, again, they're going against players. That's why we need to get them over in the contributor category. So those coaches that are deserving of the Hall of Fame get in there. A lot of it comes down, as it does all the time, to the quarterback that you have. And Donovan McNabb, as great as he was not going to be the equal of some of the quarterbacks that he went against in big games. I mean, he was able to get to championship games, but only to one Super Bowl. And like typically anything else, you're going to lose to an AFC quarterback because the AFC quarterback in his era was better than the NFC quarterbacks. And now he goes in with Alex Smith, the quarterback who I kind of put him in the Chad Pennington range, where he can get you to the playoffs but not win you a playoff game. Now he's got the quarterback that can win a Super Bowl. Now we'll get to really judge Andy Reid, because you notice he would lose these playoff games. He didn't lose last week. Patrick Mahomes gives him the quarterback that gives him the edge.
Don Coryell, I'm partial to. He presented me with the Old Town Mall Athlete of the Year Award.
Oh, no kidding. Down in San Diego?
Me and Brenda Gertz.
Oh, heck yeah.
She was a shot putter in Reno.
Yeah.
Wow. No, the Old Town Mall, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
Old Town Mall Athlete of the Year? I mean,
I'll
that's huge.
So.
I figured there was always these famous coaches and stuff coming because they wanted to come to Reno. They could get him up there for a song and probably give him some chips or something to go gamble with. Everybody wanted to come to Reno. But I just remember meeting Don Coryell. He was a super clever, really funny, kind of witty guy. Didn't he talk kind of like he had marbles in his mouth?
Yeah,
a little
he did.
Bit?
He had kind of a different type of speech thing. I still remember, because again, you remember seeing him on the sidelines. He kept himself in good shape, and he would always kind of bend over, but it looked like he was constipated the way that he bent over. I mean, it's like it was kind of painful watching that. But my favorite, I remember one time I was sitting in his office, right outside his office, waiting to interview him. And so he walks into this room with me, and he says, "Have you seen my glasses? I can't find my glasses. I got seven pairs of glasses, and I can't find any of my glasses. Where's my glasses?" And so it's like, okay, but that's how he is. I mean, he's so brilliant and was able to run around and run around the office and do all these things. And his meetings were just amazing from what people say, because what he would do, he would have all these intelligent, smart, Ernie Zampezi-type coaches, and they'd just sit around all day trying to create new plays and all that stuff. And then, of course, when necessary, I got to find my glasses. Where's my glasses? Ernie, can you help me get my glasses?
He retired up here.
It does kind of sound like
to the San Juan Islands.
Yeah.
Did he really?
Yeah, he did.
That, and he was like the father of the vertical passing game, right?
Mm-hmm. And also the digital passing offense. Because again, I mean, he made things simple. I mean, because what he would do would be coming in and say 7-3-9. That would be the quarterback play. Because the first would be one receiver doing a 7 route. Then you have another guy doing a 3 route. Then you have another guy doing a 9 route. And so with the West Coast offense, which would take like 8 seconds sometimes to get a play call in, I mean, he was able to do it in like a half a second. 7-3-6.
There you go. The Jets finalizing a deal. They're going to hire Greg Williams as their defensive coordinator. I guess is that really a surprise? Does he have much of a connection to the Jets, John?
None. No connection to the Jets. I mean, connection in the sense that he coached the Buffalo Bills and played the Jets twice a year, and that didn't work out too well for the Bills because he didn't have a good record there. But, this was anticipated, and I think this is something, I don't know if Adam was totally on board, but this is what I think what the ownership wanted. They knew Greg Williams did a great job coaching the Cleveland Browns last year as the interim coach. I think he's the only coach in Cleveland in the Browns, at least since the expansion, that has a winning record, and it's at 5-3. So this is one where I think that whoever has taken that job had to have Greg Williams. They gave him a 3-year deal. I'm sure they gave him some pretty good money, and he earned it with what he did with the Browns last year. And what's going to be interesting is that Greg is volatile. Joe Vitt, I would assume, the father-in-law of Adam Gase, is going to be on the staff too, and they were together in New Orleans, and they were volatile together. So this is going to be kind of wild. I just feel bad that Hard Knocks is not doing the Jets this year, because new coaches don't get on Hard Knocks the first year.
Who do we think might be Hard Knocks this year? Do we know any list of candidates?
Well, I mean, there's always going to be about five teams that haven't been to the playoffs, and so the Washington Redskins are going to be in the mix.
And it can't be a new coach.
Right.
Not a new coach.
A new coach, and it can't be coming off of a playoff berth.
No. So I think maybe the New York Giants might be a candidate. It can't be, obviously, the Cleveland Browns. But, a couple of these teams that have been out there for the last couple of years. But, again, that's the problem when you have seven coaching changes a year. You start to run out the candidates for Hard Knocks.
You know, one of the teams that will be a candidate is the Steelers.
That's true.
That'd be a good one.
It would be great to watch.
The 49ers would be good,
too. They went to Atlanta already, I guess.
Yep, we've seen them in Atlanta. Anything new on Antonio Brown, John?
Oh, nothing can be new because the trade deadline is not until March, and nobody's going to really start talking trade until you start to get near the combine. The things that I think you start to look at is that there's a good market for him, and he will get traded. I think for the most part, he's going to land somehow in the Bay Area more than anything else, but Denver's going to bid on him. Would not surprise me if Jacksonville bids on him. But the team, I think, San Francisco is definitely going to be in the mix for him. In fact, Jerry Rice has already been talking to him, and Antonio Brown says that he's going to start training in the hill, that hill that Jerry always runs with Jerry. So, he's angling to get to the 49ers, but the problem is, they're going to take a defensive player at the top of the draft, and so the best thing they can do is offer a second-round pick. Now, Oakland, I think, it got the best chance to get him because, remember, they have three first-round picks and needs everywhere, but they can offer the picks either 27 or 24 and give them a first-round pick and maybe something else. So I could see him going to the Raiders, although I don't know if he wants to go to the Raiders because, one, they don't know where they're playing yet, and, number two, they're not going to win.
Hey, John, of the losers from last weekend, so we got Cowboys, Colts, Chargers and Eagles. Who do you think has the brightest future of those four teams?
I think Indianapolis.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say too. Because Andrew Luck really had a good comeback, and it seems like Frank Reich. Mm-hmm. What a good deal that is for him. And even though they weren't able to beat Kansas City, I just think that was a tremendous year for them, considering how it started out with the whole coaching thing.
Yeah, and I mean, Andrew, I'm sure, is going to win Comeback Player of the Year. I know he won it on the Pro Football Writers card, and he's going to, AP will have their awards coming up, I guess, on the eve of the Super Bowl with the official announcement, but I think he's going to win Comeback Player of the Year. So I think that you can almost count on that. Today, he was the first alternate to the Pro Bowl, and so Phillip Rivers pulled out, and so Andrew's in the Pro Bowl right now. So it's kind of funny because the two guys that people were complaining about not making the Pro Bowl now in the Pro Bowl. That's Russell Wilson and Andrew Luck, the two quarterbacks from 2012. And of course, the other 2012 quarterback that really gained a lot of steam was Nick Foles, who is going to probably go to Jacksonville or some other team because of what his success had been in the playoffs, winning four out of five games. So I think that you look at Indianapolis, they were one of the best defenses in football the second half of the season. They have good young talent. They got a good guy in Chris Ballard picking the players. I think they're set now to take over the division again.
I'm really excited to see Nick Foles because you look at last year, it didn't go as great this year, but last year three games, he's six touchdowns and one interception, 73% passer. I mean, that guy deserves to go somewhere and start, and hopefully, I'm hoping it's going to be Denver, but just wherever he lands. I mean, Jacksonville probably be a good deal too because they got a running game and a good defense, but. I want to see that guy have some success and be his own, kind of crawl out of that, kind of like Case Keenum couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you hear what John Elway said? And, of course, obviously you're a John Elway student because, I mean, you know him from Stanford so well, is that, John said that Case Keenum is our short-term quarterback. And so technically they can go with him and then draft a quarterback, with the 10th pick in the draft. And if they do that, then I think that, but I think what it comes down to, would they rather, eat the contract of Case Keenum and then come back and sign Nick Foles on a one-year deal? But that's going to cost over $20 million because I think he's earned that right. Although, again, it's like anything else. It's open bidding, and he may not be able to get it because there's not a lot of teams looking for quarterbacks. And so you either stay with Case and draft a first rounder, or you try to get rid of Case and then bring in Foles and get a first rounder. So, again, this is only going to be a one-year situation. So they're looking short-term, not long-term. But I'll tell you one thing. They made probably the Vic Fangio thing is looking great. because what they were able to do is get Mike Munchak. And Mike Munchak is going to be as impactful going to Denver as Mike Solari was going to Seattle.
Hey, getting back to the Colts, John, why did Frank Reich get rid of his offensive line coach? Because I thought they had a good year there.
Yeah, and they did have a good year, but this was a Joshy Boy McDaniels hire. And Joshy Boy, you know, brought him up when, of course, you abandoned him. And again, showing you how savage the Joshy Boy McDaniels thing is, because, you know, you're your own coach and you want your own coaches. And you want your own assistance. And so as much as Frank has to respect the job that he did, he let him go because this was Joshy's hire and not his hire. And so I know that he liked the guy that's on this, you know, as a staff, as the assistant, and promoted him. And so it's just one of those things where if you're a coach, I mean, you take a situation that you come in that late. I mean, you can't rock the boat. You got to accept what's there. But ultimately, if you're going to be a good coach, you want your guys. And unfortunately, as good as this guy coached, he wasn't his guy.
One note, Heath Farwell, who people remember here as a really good special teams player for the Seahawks, he's going to be the Bills. He's been hired as the Bills' new special teams coordinator that's there. The Seahawks have Brian Schneider. They also have Larry Izzo. I'll be interested to see kind of if there's any change or how that working relationship evolves, because I think people are pretty high on Izzo.
Yeah, I think they are too. And, you know, one thing that I think Pete has been able to do is, you know, kind of groom good assistants of special teams coaches and set them up. But I think Brian Snyder's too good to let go. I really respect him and what he was able to do. You know, I thought, you know, he probably had the best insight, I mean, as early as, say, you know, May of last year, of how this thing was going to go as far as the kickoff returns and all that. I mean, and I think that he's a real good one. You would hope there's not a change. But again, if the two minds work together well, it's a good thing for Pete.
Here's something you don't see too often. Mike Smith, who used to be the head coach of the Atlanta Falcons and most recently was the defensive coordinator of the Bucks, but was let go. He's indicated he's done coaching, that he's not interested in pursuing any more opportunities. You don't usually see guys sort of bow out publicly like that.
No, you don't. And I think what it comes down to is that, you know, he must feel that, you know, his systems are just outdated. Now, remember, I mean, he was a pure cover two guy. And, pure cover two defenses, just they're outdated. I mean, you can't do them because, again, there's too many guys catching balls out of the backfield. I still remember watching Chicago Bear games with Lovie Smith going against New Orleans. And, you know, the Bears' cover two defense would stifle, even at home games for Drew Brees. I mean, his quarterback ratings were in, like, the 60s and 70s in some of those games. But then what happens? You get Jimmy Graham. He creases the seam. Then you get your receiver on the outside running the six route. And if he's covered, then you dump the balls off to Darren Sproles. So over a three-year period, once they got Sproles, once they had Graham established, and once they had a good receiver to do the outside right route, you just destroyed cover two, and the Bears couldn't keep up. And that's the game right now. I mean, cover two has evolved into cover one, cover three. You know, you can still use cover two, but not like you did before. And I think that Mike Smith relied too much on that, and now I think that system is outdated, and I think that Mike realizes 59, time to get out.
I don't know if you saw this, but Greg Bedard, who is a former Sports Illustrated writer, he now runs the Boston Sports Journal. They had a tombstone that they put up after the game on Sunday. Seattle's cover three defense was the tomb. Born September 16th, 2012, which would that be the game against the Cowboys? Seattle, Washington. Died January 13th, 2019, Foxborough, Massachusetts. Had a good run, but like other schemes, Tom Brady killed it. He declared the cover three scheme dead because Gus Bradley was running the Chargers and they got eviscerated.
That's stupid.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. That's just so ridiculous.
That's stupid.
I mean, come on.
Well, it is, and it's, you know, all of those things work, you know, and, you know, if you want to run cover two, it's a heavy underneath dropper zone. You only got two guys deep, but, you know, there's all of those things work. They're all separate coverages. They're different in different ways, and it's how you run them and your rules that you have and all that. So
would you say they're like snowflakes? They're each one's unique?
No, I wouldn't, Danny.
By the way, do you think Greg thinks the Saints defense is any good?
No, I don't think he likes the Saints defense.
Oh, well, because it's cover one, cover three?
Who's this?
Greg Bedard.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah. Wasn't he a pitcher for the Mariners?
No, that was Eric Bedard.
No, but and nobody liked Eric Bedard.
I've got an autographed ball from Eric Bedard at home. I ran into it the other day. I was like, hey, what's this? I'm like, oh, it's an autographed ball by Eric Bedard. What should I do? Should I light it on fire?
Well, no, but just make sure you get rid of it before the sixth inning because he was never going to get past the fifth.
Very good one, John. Very good one. He was five and dive. He was coming out of the game. He once left a game in which he had not allowed a hit. He was working on a no-hitter, and he tapped out.
But he got to 100?
Yep. He was like, I'm done. Thanks. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of guts to leave a game when you've got no hits allowed.
That would be bad. Yeah, I would agree with that.
John, what do you think? We were having our Kyler Murray discussion. So here's what I thought. Like, I think the NFL would spit you up and chew you out. Oh, I got that backwards.
Spit you up and chew you out.
Yeah, that sounds
go
like
that
something.
Way too.
Wouldn't that be like a great slow motion thing? I mean, you see the spit coming right back, you know, come right back in your mouth.
Gross, if there's anybody that could do it would be Saban, who could spit you up and then chew you out.
Yeah, right. So chew you up, spit you out. NFL, it would happen faster in the NFL than it would in baseball. So, like, if you were 50-50 on this, go football first, and if it doesn't work, you'll probably know in the first year or two, and you'll still be able to go, and, you know, there's a minor league, and you can kind of develop your skills. What do you think?
I guess. I mean, that's the thing I think is going to be so intriguing about what Seattle and other teams are going to do for backup quarterbacks and maybe third quarterbacks, because now, you know, with the Alliance of American Football, you know, developing and giving quarterbacks a chance to go play, now it's not like you say, well, Alex looks good. Alex Magoo looks good, who went to Jacksonville today. But it's like, we don't know how he can do. And you're not going to necessarily have to start the season with as many as 9 quarterbacks as backups that have never played before. So I think this is going to be kind of a new wave that's going to be happening.
Drew Brees turning 40 today, John. You look at his numbers from this year, 74% through for 4,000 yards, 32 touchdowns, 5 interceptions. You think who's going to last longer, Brees or Tom Brady?
Probably Tom Brady. I mean, he's not going to give it up. I mean, at some point, I think, you know, Drew may just take the tack that because, you know, Drew's such a nice guy that you know, let's say that he wins the Super Bowl. I mean, would it be out of the touch? I mean, he can play 2 more years, I think. But I think that both are in such comfortable situations because both have coaches that maybe not the head coach in New England for Tom Brady. But I think that they have, you know, Joshy Boy McDaniels, who he feels comfortable with. And there's no doubt that Drew Brees feels real comfortable with Sean Payton. And so if it works, why break it up?
Saints defensive tackle Sheldon Rankins, he tore his Achilles in the last game. John, how much will that affect New Orleans?
It's going to hurt because, again, he was, I think, a number 2, number 3 alternate to the Pro Bowl and a very good run stuffer, and you take that out of the mix, particularly for a team like the Rams that ran for 273 yards on Saturday night, it's not going to help because, yeah, they've got a good backup that's going to be able to step in and do some things, but that's not going to be the same. That's a big loss for them.
He is the professor, John. We always appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you missed any of the Cold Hard Facts brought to you by Frost Brewed Coors Light, you can download the podcast, 710sports.com. The Seahawks, they haven't used this in 9 years. Is it time for them to break out the franchise tag? We'll tell you next.
You're listening to Danny, Dave, and Moore.
Live from the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
It's a happy hour. It's brought to you by Heritage Distillings, batch number 12 vodka.
Hey, Danny, can we make an Adam Gase emoji?
Yeah, I think there already is one, isn't there?
One of those little smiley faces with eyes
just
popping out.
Eyes
of it.
Popping all of the way out. It'll now be the Adam Gase emoji. Yeah.
That is one of the weirdest things ever.
It certainly gives you reason for pause. Like, you look at it and you're like, what is going on? Like, that just didn't look right.
I thought it was weird when, and Jess has noticed this too, Antonio Brown, he was on Dancing with the Stars. He does this thing when there's like a still shot of him. Well, it's not a still, it's not a photo.
It's like a live headshot.
Live headshot, and I didn't call it a mugshot this time. How about that?
Hey!
I call everybody's picture a mugshot.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah, but anyways, his headshot, and he does this thing where the whites of his eyes get really big. It's almost an Adam Gase thing, but not quite.
Adams was like perpetually that way. You're like, whoa, 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 whoa.
Well, and Antonio kind of looked like he was doing it on purpose to be goofy.
Right.
Adam Gase looked possessed.
Yes.
There's an important distinction there.
Yeah.
He does look possessed in that.
Yeah, it's disconcerting to say the least. The Seahawks have not used their franchise tag since 2010, I believe, when it was applied to Olindo Mare. That was Pete Carroll's and John Schneider's first year here in town. They're staring at the possibility, in fact, I would even say the probability of using it on Frank Clark. And here's the one trickle-down effect that I've come up with. If you franchise tag Frank Clark this year, it puts more pressure on getting an extension done with Russell Wilson. Because if they both enter the season, Frank Clark on the franchise tag and Russell entering the final year of his contract, you're then looking at the fact that one of those guys would get to unrestricted free agency the following year. That you can get hemmed in there where you could be put in a situation where you've got to meet one of their prices to avoid losing one of those guys getting to that. And now you can always solve that by slapping two deals on the table and saying whoever takes it first gets it and the other guy gets the tag, which was what they did in 2005. I don't know if you remember that. Matt Hasselbeck, Sean Alexander, and Walter Jones were all free agents, scheduled to be free agents at the exact same time. And it was also a time where they didn't have their general manager. And Sean ended up being the one that was kind of left without a seat because Walter got a contract, and then Matt Hasselbeck got a contract, and then Sean got the tag.
I don't remember that. Wow. That was your first year covering
it
the
was.
Seahawks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Is there any – what would be the reason why you would franchise tag Frank? I mean, other than the one or the other, just because – I just wonder if there's concern over – you know, like, is this a long-term guy for us? And to me, I think he has proven that he is. Of course, we don't know every detail, but, I mean, Frank is, he's an amazing kid, as far as we know, and what we're seeing and everything. I'm just curious, like, is he maybe behind the scenes a guy that wants to get out of here and get the highest price tag and things like that? It sure doesn't seem like it.
Yeah, the two reasons for Seattle would be that you'd have any hesitation about doing whatever it took to get him to a long-term contract. The two reasons. The first would be you're at least a little uncertain about how he will handle getting that much money paid. Will that affect the way he plays, the way he prepares, any of that? I actually think that's less of a consideration than the second part, which is strictly financial in that you are negotiating with him at the high point of his leverage. Not only is he about to become a free agent, but he's coming off the best season of his career. Of his four seasons, this was a significant step forward in all of those. And you might want to say, like, okay, let's see if he can sustain that for another year. And if he does that, then you know it wasn't just a blip up in a contract year. The contract year usually happens to seven-footers in the NBA. There's a long and storied history of guys. Sometimes it's only for a month that they would play good. But suddenly, when they're going to become a free agent, the seven-footer gets magically motivated. And all of a sudden, he starts playing like everybody could. And you're like, oh, my gosh, we can't lose this guy. He's turned the corner. He's arrived. Let's give Jerome James $30 million over 5 years. And then about 2 months later, you're like, why in the world did we do that?
Does that only happen here in Seattle or everywhere in the NBA?
Everywhere. It's a nationwide epidemic. And I've never understood it. Is it something about seven-footers that makes them more like likely to loaf when they're not in a contract year? Like, it's a very specific happened with Calvin Booth. Like, all these guys who all of a sudden when they're going to become free agents were great. Benoit Benjamin. Now that I think about it, most of these guys have played in Seattle.
Benoit Benjamin.
And there's a long list of guys who were thoroughly terrible except for the 2 months before
they
were scheduled.
He wasn't terrible, though.
Benoit Benjamin was awful.
Check his stats. Oh. Go ahead and Google Benoit Benjamin and tell me he was terrible.
Actually,
his attitude could have used some improvement.
Yeah,
that guy was a double double machine with the Clippers, and he did okay here too. But he was a piece of work.
I just looked up.
I'll give you that he was a piece of work, but terrible does not qualify for Benoit Benjamin.
I just looked up underachiever in the dictionary, and Benoit's picture is right next to it.
That is not true.
Yeah, it is.
That is just not true. All right, you get back to me on that, and I'll that part that you bring up about Russell Wilson concerns me a little bit. I mean, if you franchise Frank Clark, then you put yourself kind of in a corner there with Russell Wilson. So I don't know what you do with Clark. If you franchise him, it's around $17 or $18 million that he's going to get for 2019. So hopefully they can get something done. I'd be a little concerned too with Frank Clark. I'd want to see if he could do it one more year, like you were saying, after you give him with giving him that much money, but. He's only 25. He turns 26 in June, and so you've got a guy there that can be productive and be a pass rusher and for, what, 6 or 7 more years to come.
Did you cover Benoit Benjamin?
Yeah, 1 year.
Because I'm looking at it. He did average a double-double 1 year. It was the first year that he was here in Seattle. What was weird about him? He wore 0-0, right? Did he wear double zeros?
He just kind of had a weird attitude. He just didn't seem...
Did he not care?
He didn't seem completely engaged. Yeah, he seemed like a guy that once he got his money that he was just going to coast.
Seems very similar to many other seven-footers.
But his numbers are good, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. They're better than I thought they were.
Yeah,
yeah, that would kind of be frustrating, though, because he seemed very lackadaisical.
I remember I saw him in Edmonds one time.
Really?
Yeah. He lived near where my wife's grandma used to live.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. He kind of stood out walking around.
Yeah, I mean, 7 feet tall. He's going to stand out.
Yeah. Well, I know in his past and everything, there might be, you know, something like that. It's a good point you make, though. I mean, if you can franchise tag him, and the thing is he going to get upset with that? I don't know, man. $15 million, is that what it is? It's like 14 and a half?
I think it's even higher. I think it's like 17. I think he'd end up getting 17. And it sounds like, and this is mostly comes from Brady Henderson, who's done a great job of covering this and talking to Frank's agent, that Frank's prepared for the idea of it and looking at it as a way of, you know what, you get a great one-year salary, and there's risk, but you also get another bite at the market a year from now,
right,
where you're either going to get a 20% raise on what you just made, or you're going to get to enter the market then, that if you play your tail off, you can really parlay that. It's an opportunity.
Isn't that what Joe Flacco did?
Flacco played two free agency and won a Super Bowl right as he was going to become a free agent.
Yeah, that's right. It was the last year. He didn't want to scrap up the old deal. So, yeah, I mean, you can get that. That's a good benefit, as long as it's not anything. The only thing you're sacrificing is long-term security, right? I talked to Luke Wilson one time about this and other players, and one of the things that it was Bradley McDougal I talked to last year, and, you know, he said, I said, what's it like on a one-year deal? Because he was on a one-year deal, wasn't he?
Yes, he did. Yeah. He played last year on a one-year
deal. And he said, you know what? They all feel like one-year deals. You know, so unless you have, you know, some kind of a guarantee, and that's probably what Frank is risking there. But I've really loved the way he's handled it, the way he's talked about the money and everything. You don't see any kind of bitterness or anything like that. And that's the thing we talk about with this group, like who's going to be the guy that gets paid and then all of a sudden becomes difficult.
I'll say this. It's one of the amazing things. Seattle, for the most part, has avoided that. Certainly more. They have not paid a guy who's then coasted. They've paid guys that have then become headaches.
They got full
of
themselves.
That's what I mean. I don't mean coasting. I mean
too,
like,
big for their britches.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, and that's I don't see Frank being that way, but you never know. But, yeah, that's the only risk for him really is that, you know, every player wants to get that long-term deal with guarantees.
Because then you get the money up front and you're in the same spot for 2 to 3 years.
What would you do, Danny? I mean, when you throw the Russell Wilson part of it in there.
I franchise tag Frank, and I say that we'll figure that out when we get to it. I would play it that way and say that if they got to this point without getting Frank to agree to terms on a contract extension and that they've been working at that, I really think that it's a matter of his price being really, really high. And I'd like to see another year of this productivity before I paid multiple years expecting him to sustain.
What's Aaron Donald getting? Is he 20?
Aaron's up above 20. But that's
so that's probably what Clark's looking at.
He's probably saying
that.
And that's the thing is Frank Clark's a great player and he's had a really good year, but he's had one year that stood out above all the others. And before I made that kind of commitment, I'd want to see him do it again.
Yeah. And as long as he's not unhappy about it, because he's headed that way, at least we think. And so if he's okay with it, then why not?
It's Danny Davenport. This is the Happy Hour. It's brought to you by Heritage Distillings Batch Number 12 Vodka. Coming up next, Joe Ingles is Australian for Trash Talk. We'll explain.
Sweeping the dial. Streaming everywhere on the 710 Seattle Sports app and 710sports.com.
Watch him talk to the fan. There's some Piston fans over there.
Blows him a kiss. The one and only Jingle and Joe with a...
He's like, you've been talking all game over there.
Jingle and Joe. That's Joe Ingles. It's too bad we don't have an NBA team anymore, because there's some really fun personalities in this league, and this guy is one of them. He's Australian, and he's not shy about talking. Dave, you would love Joe Ingles, because he is a reflection back to that time when teams hated one another.
Yes, yeah, and I think that we should, call me sentimental, but there should be more hatred. Don't you think?
Yeah. Yes, it's more exciting than it was. I went and looked up some of the best things that Ingles has done. Ingles told Blake Griffin to his face that he was a flopper. Just said, you're a flopper. Got into it back and forth with Russell Westbrook. Annoyed Paul George. Annoyed the bejesus out of Paul George in last year's playoffs.
Kind of player is he? Is he good?
Yeah, he is.
Who's the biggest jerk that you remember? The guy that I loved to hate the most was Bill Laimbeer.
Yeah?
I couldn't stand Laimbeer.
Seemed like he was a dirty player.
Yeah, see, and that's the thing about him. Kind of reminded me of Steve Wisniewski that I used to play against, that he wasn't like a tough guy or a badass. He was more of just an instigator, you know? Like, Steve Wisniewski was a good player. He was a pro bowler, but he wasn't going to come out and blow you up or anything. But he was just always pushing you afterwards, and I felt like Lambeer did a lot of that.
Dirtiest player that was in the league when I covered him was Bruce Bowen. Bowen would slide his feet under a jump shooter.
He
hurt Vince Carter doing it, and he did it to Ray Allen too.
Guys, so he turns an ankle.
Yeah, guys really hated Bruce Bowen.
You know who the Sonics used to complain about? Gary and Nate, John Stockton.
Yeah, Stockton's filthy.
Yeah,
really?
You wouldn't think so, yeah. But John Stockton. What kind of stuff? For him. Just chippy stuff.
Hit you on a screen.
Yeah.
Run into you. I think they respected him. They felt like he didn't get as many fouls called on him, though, because he was the little white guy. And he was getting picked on by everybody. And that he gave as good as he get. Jerry Sloan had some great quotes. One of them was that he said, I think there's about 5 real men left in the NBA. And I coach 2 of them, Karl Malone and John Stockton. He also loved Gary Payton. But Sloan was a dirty player, too.
Yeah, Jerry Sloan, though. Boy, he was fun. I used to love those series with the Jazz and talking to Jerry. He was great.
Jerry Sloan is the most profane coach I've ever heard in my life.
Really?
Yes.
Barrett, the time running out. R.J. Barrett, a deep three. And Chukwu, fittingly, the ball in his hands as the game ends. Jim Boeheim, another win over the number one ranked team in the country. His first as an unranked Syracuse team since the Big East tournament of 2006.
Duke was down 2 of its better players. They weren't at full strength. They lose to the Cuse. I'm definitely not rooting for the Cuse.
Why not?
You don't like
Boeheim. You don't like the zone defense.
That's correct.
It's the motherland of the zone defense.
Are you still on that?
I'm not complaining about the Huskies playing it anymore, but I'm not going to like it at Syracuse.
All right.
That's a long-held grievance I have against...
You know, the darn thing about it, Danny, is it works. They went in and upset Duke. You guys got a team this year. Usually I'm follow college basketball. You know who I like? I like the Huskies.
Yeah! I like to hear it. Jalen Noel.
I like the Beavers.
Beavs? Trace Tinkles?
I'm pulling for the Beavers. I've given up on the Cougs. I'll keep watching them, but we don't play defense, whether it's man-to-man or zone. Doesn't really matter.
No defense either way?
Yeah, you know, that bothers me. That really does. I was talking to Stevie Mikey about it the other day. Okay, I know that we lack talent, but you can still hustle and play defense, even when you suck offensively. You know, we got Ellaby and Franks is supposedly coming back. But play some defense. Play some defense, and we don't do it over there.
How do we end up talking about the Cougars?
I don't know.
It's okay.
Look at you, shut the whole system down.
What happened?
I'm looking for an Owen Asherus. Yeah. Can I come see
you just a minute, please?
Just doing my
follow-up for
a detective. And I
want to
make sure I've got the right person.
Is this
you, sir? Yeah.
Oh. Owen Asherus, visited by a police officer
in a team meeting
to find out he got a scholarship.
This could have gone wrong.
What if he just gets up and
what
bolts?
What if he's like...
He bolts from the room.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry I stole that laptop or something like that. Just, I'm sorry. I know I parked in a bad spot or whatever.
Well, see, I was thinking more of like he bowls over the cop. You're never taking me alive, coppers!
He showed the officer showed him a piece of paper, and then he was looking at it like, oh, what did I do wrong? And then he was able to read what he saw on there getting the scholarship. So
Those things are really cool.
Yeah, the players, his teammates got all excited for him. He has it. He's played in 7 games, but he hasn't scored yet. But, yeah, it's still a cool story.
Just Danny stole your 1930s gangster talk there.
What's that all about, hey?
Hey, I'm horning in on your bit.
All of a sudden, walk into a gin joint, and there you are.
Couple of flapper girls running out there in the street. We had to tell them to take cover.
I used to be a flapper girl. Don't do me like that, Johnny.
A couple of wiseacres in here, I see.
Where's your bolo hat? Hanging up on the hat rack, which I assume was in bars around this time?
The the thing about when you see these things about guys getting scholarships, we talk so much about like sort of, oh, college sports are so corrupt and how kids are taken advantage of. And there's a big part of me that feels that the system needs significant reform. When you see moments like that, though, you realize that the system does work for an awful lot of kids.
That's the thing we never talk about is how much it works for everybody else, you know, and it, like I get in this argument sometimes with like Bob and Groz, you know, and both of them are like, you know, we'll say, well, hey, listen, the athletes I hear from don't like it. They'd like money. And I'm like, I was in that system. And what about the ones that you don't hear about? I mean, I don't think it's a significant number. I just think if it really, if you went and pulled pretty much or pulled every college player, I'd say 90% would say that they were pretty happy with the exchange. There's some things though that are screwed up. You're right. Alabama, I mean, did those guys even go to class? I mean, are there, you can't schedule any kind of a class or anything if football gets in the way. And it used to be the other way around. So that part has to change. And then, you know, the commitment that they make to the athletes. But I would say for most people, it's a really good exchange. And that's why I love whenever we play one of these.
It's Danny, Dave, and Moore. That wraps up the happy hour. We got 5 questions at 5 o'clock. 5 questions for the Seahawks. That's coming up next.